Hello, welcome to Base Camp for Men. I'm your host, Tony Rizak. This is a show that gives you insights and resources in how to live a more courageous life. We look to assist you on your hero's journey in any way that we can. Truth is our compass, humanity, our tribe. Welcome and let's get started. Hello, Base Campers. I hope you're all doing well. Today's episode is not really a Bitcoin episode per se, but rather a conversation with a very intelligent young man about what he sees in the macroeconomic environment as it relates to our future. I have said that we will continue to feature Bitcoiners on this show. Not every episode. Base Camp is not a Bitcoin podcast, but I like what Bitcoiners bring to the table. Street smarts, intelligence about monetary properties, intuition, and a healthy dose of optimism and foresight. In my view, Bitcoiners are one of the only subgroups bringing light and humor and insight into the narrative war. The fact that they are preaching adoption of the hardest money on the planet is almost the cherry on top, so to speak. Between tariffs and de-dollarization and trade and narrative wars, it can be difficult to see clearly. We are in the cognitive dissonance phase for many people. Certainly the normies are getting this in spades. A sort of what the fuck is happening vibe is all over the place right now. And this is where the stone cold conviction of the Bitcoiners again stands alone. What other subgroup is cutting through the fog the way Bitcoiners are? None that I can see. Let's get to our interview. It's a really good one. And once again, none of this should be taken as financial advice. I'm not saying you should buy Bitcoin. I'm a libertarian through and through. You do you, Base Camper, and I'm going to continue to do me. I'm simply sharing what I have found to be valuable in this narrative war. That is all. Enjoy the interview. Today's episode is brought to you by Stand Up Now Apparel. Stand Up Now has amazing designs centered on God, family, freedom, and patriotism. They use only the softest cotton in their designs and have gear for the whole family. There's something for everyone, Base Campers. I know you're going to love their products. Go support them at www.standupnowapparel.com and use the code BASECAMP to receive a 10% discount and free shipping. And now, on to our interview. My guest today goes by the name Peruvian Bull. He is a former analyst in fintech and a writer on finance and monetary policy. He's also the author of the book, The Dollar Endgame. Here is my interview. All right, I am here with Peruvian Bull, American Peruvian Bull, Bitcoiner and author. PB, welcome to Base Camp for Men. It is great to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me on. I'm excited for this one.
Yeah, me too. You know, you and I met recently through one of the Bitcoin apps, went and had coffee, hit it off. You connected me to Ben Werman, another great young guy that's a Bitcoiner and a thought leader. And so you were game for this, which I was super thankful for. And you just got back from Japan. At first, I didn't know what, I thought maybe you were just going over there on a culture trip, but I found out you were at Metaplanets. Meeting a Metaplanet, of course, the big leader in Japan in stacking sats. How was the trip to Japan? Was it inspiring? Are Japanese starting to come around to Bitcoin? Like what's going on over in Asia right now? Did you find out?
Yeah, well, it was an incredible trip. I'll say that, you know, the Japanese economy and the Japanese culture is something that's, you know, one of a kind. That's not even, I don't think there's even a really good parallel in Asia itself, much less the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. But Japan has been the victim of essentially like extreme financial repression, right, for the last 30 years with 0% interest rates and QE infinity, yield curve control. And just constant demographic decline and stagnation. And so the people have been kind of like hungering for a solution. But the problem is obviously most Japanese corporations are so rigid in their thinking that they would never even consider something like Bitcoin. Mm. And Metaplanet was the first publicly listed company in Japan to acquire Bitcoin. And they did so in size. And obviously their stock has rocketed upwards, thousands and thousands of percent in the last year alone. They started the strategy in like April of 2024, and then they accelerated it in October and November of last year as Trump won the presidency and their sister company, MicroStrategy did as well, which they're kind of emulating their Bitcoin treasury strategy. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the documentary that we filmed was mainly about the Japanese yen and the economy, but we obviously, did include Metaplanet in there as well. We wanted to highlight the hopeful upturn at the end of the dark tunnel of Japanese economic history that is Metaplanet and Bitcoin. more generally.
Nice. I was wondering, and I wanted to ask you about it. You use Peruvian Bull as a pseudonym. I think that's so smart. I remember years ago, before I got kicked off of Twitter for questioning the vaccines, that there was a guy on Twitter, I don't know if he's still on there, and he used a pseudonym called Mars Dorian, and he had this kind of cool brand. And I always thought that's a really smart idea to create your content. It frees you up to not, have this character assassination or people pointing at you saying, "Oh, we can't hire him because look at these radical views," right? And Twitter was back in the day, especially when I got kicked off, it was notorious for pointing at people and kind of blacklisting them and shadow banning them. And then you could really get in, especially in an area like Seattle, you could get singled out for like, "Hey, we did a little dive on Twitter or X or whatever. He thinks this, so don't ever, everybody, don't do business with him." I don't know if that's why you create under a pseudonym, or it's because of Bitcoin, which is another reason to maybe create privacy for yourself. But I wanted to ask you about that. I think it's a genius idea, one that I would consider using as well at this point.
Yeah, no, that's so my name comes from Reddit, actually. That's where I started writing. And when I was in 2019, I was getting into Wall Street bets and, stock investing. And I'd been studying macro for like the, 3 or 4 years before, but I'd been primarily a gold investor. Unfortunately, I was FUDded out of Bitcoin from a 2017 book I read, and so I sold all my Bitcoin, and I thought it was gonna just slowly grind to zero. And so I was just buying gold because I still believed in the, Austrian economics, monetary theory that basically like the global sovereign debt cycle is upon us, and they're gonna have to print their way out. So I was like, okay, gold's the hedge here. But when I wanted to get, other stocks in the mix, I was getting into Wall Street bets, and so I had to think of a username that would be, I guess, conducive to who I was, but also not give away, my actual identity. And I went with Peruvian Bull, Peruvian, because my mom is Peruvian, my dad's American, so I was born here and I was educated here, but I do have Peruvian citizenship and lineage. And then I have the bull because I was interested in finance, and so, and I was studying macro, and I was working at an insurance company, but at that time. So that's why I chose that name. But it's kind of evolved over time, ironically. Like, it's become PB, Peruvian, or just Bull. Like, people just call me whatever. I don't mind. But I just ported that same username from Reddit once I wrote the Dollar Endgame series, which went viral on there. I ported it over to Twitter, and then I ported it to YouTube, and everyone, it's gotten to the point where people don't even want to know my real name anymore.
Yeah,
They just want to
that's
call me
great.
PB.
That's awesome. So let's just, before we get into Dollar Endgame and that stuff, where are you from? Like, what's your background? Without giving away any privacy stuff, where did you grow up? And like, what kinds of things besides insurance have you done for workers? Was that your primary, industry that you worked in prior to all the content creating and stuff that you're doing now?
Yeah, sure. So I grew up in the Pacific Northwest, around Seattle, not actually in Seattle, but around in the greater Seattle area. And I went to a local high school, and then I went to college in Washington State. I got degrees in finance, economics, and entrepreneurship. And like I said, I worked in insurance briefly, and then I went to work for a fintech firm, actually like a startup private equity fintech firm. I was doing valuations for early stage software companies mostly. Did that for about 3.5 years, and then, all this time that I was working at this fintech, I was posting macro content. I was growing my Twitter account, and once it got to like 30,000 followers, and in December of 2023, I was like, I need to pull the trigger and just do this full time and see where it takes me. And so I quit my job, and took a big hit on the chin with in terms of income. But I was like, I'll rather pursue my passion of writing macro. And yeah, I just launched into this full time. So, I'm relatively younger. I'm under 30. Obviously, I'm going to turn 28 this year. But I've done a ton of research on economics and finance, and people have really enjoyed my writing. So I think that that speaks for itself.
You're a really good writer, actually. I was like really pleasantly not surprised, but I was like, God, he really is. He's really good with this. Well, good for you. I mean, you and Ben, two young guys taking a hero's journey, a road less traveled. It's super inspiring. I think you're going to inspire, and you are inspiring, lots of young people that feel trapped. I mean, insurance just sounds like a shit fucking industry to work in, right? Like, I just like, God, I can't imagine just like, I work in insurance, right? Like, you guys, now, not everyone's going to quickly, I'm not saying you quickly built to 30,000 followers, but some people are not going to be able to build that kind of following necessarily without being a good writer like you and Ben are. But I think you two have trailblazed that it doesn't need to be done the old way. And fiat is crumbling. Like, you don't need to do it the fiat way because that's like a castle made of sand. Why not build over here with sovereignty and a store of value that increases over time? So I think you guys are really putting it together. And Ben, with are you a carnivore too? I was going to ask you about that. Ben's
Yeah,
the,
I am a carnivore. Yeah, Ben took me
he's
down the
a,
rabbit hole, my friend.
I
Very deep.
can't I can't do it, man. I'm going more carnivore, but I can't, I just can't go all, like, I just like vegetables too much. And I'm not really, I haven't turned into a vegetables are not good for you person, right? And I talk to people and they're like, eh, you know, so I'm not there yet. I'm trying to eat healthy. I'm trying to do more carnivore, but I haven't quite got to where you guys are. And I'm a lot older, so I don't know where, you know, I don't know where I'm gonna land on all that. But you know, in the Dollar Endgame, which is your book and your series, you know, you kind of lay out this kind of dying fiat model. And I think that most people can't conceive of it in the United States. Now, people can conceive of it in other nations, say like Argentina, where they have just a crippled currency. They can speak to it much more clearly and accurately than Americans can. I think we have been lulled to sleep because of the American dollar being the reserve currency. And even like all the TradFi guys I talk to, they just poo-poo that we could, that the dollar, they don't even really acknowledge that the dollar is losing purchasing power in a real way. You can see that they brush it over, like, yeah, but you know, it's almost like they're saying, well, if you can get close to the printer and make a lot of money, what does it really matter, right? So they're actually not considering it as a possibility for a lot of people. And I just wanted to ask you, like, are we in this kind of tipping point where more and more people are going to become aware that the dollar is shit, that the dollar is buying less and less every single year? You know, what is your take on that? Because I used to think we're right off, we're right on it, and maybe some of that was my own kind of, I don't want to say desire to see the system crumble because I think it would freak out a lot of people, including us probably. But I used to think we were really close, but I've been listening to a lot of podcasts that are like that, something like that might be 50 years out. And I'm like, okay, wait a minute. Maybe I'm viewing too many things with a high time preference, wanting to see this shift. What is your take on all that? Are we the boiling frog, but we're a long ways from it boiling at this point?
I think it's, I mean, okay, if you read my book, you'll kind of grasp the nuance here, right? Because it's very complex. But I think it depends on the actions of the Fed, the Treasury, and other central banks globally, right? If other central banks are agreeing to hold our long-term debt and become bag holders essentially of the US, you know, government bond market, then you can extend the game much, much longer. And if you are able to ameliorate the concerns in the banking system, and you're able to ameliorate the concerns with, you know, weakening the weakening economy without causing massive sell-offs in stock prices, you can kind of like stumble things along, like barely well enough, for much longer than people think, right? That's what Japan has been doing actually for the last 30 years. They had a slow-moving depression in the 90s, and they kind of just lowered interest rates to zero, froze everything in time. You know, didn't see any stock market growth, but on the alternative, they didn't see any further destruction, right? And so they kind of got this stagnant economy as payback for it. But up until 2022, they hadn't really paid the piper for their, you know, monetary sins. And finally, now the carry trade is starting to blow out their currency, and they're seeing inflation, the Japanese CPI. this first quarter of 2025 was 4.1%. So they're really seeing inflation now come back in a major way, and finally the consequences are rolling. But you know, everyone called for the Japanese economy to implode or for inflation to return back in the early 2000s. And this is 20 years later that it's finally coming to pass. So I think, you know, it's a complex thing to parse apart. But the main thing to remember is that the U.S. dollar is the world reserve currency, and as the world reserve currency, other people hold our debt and other people hold our assets in order to, you know, use as basically like a recycling vector for the dollars that they receive from us. Because we're a net exporter, we export all this money. Because we're importing goods. Sorry, we're a net exporter of dollars, so we're a net importer of goods, right? We have trade deficits. So all these dollars flood into the global economy. All these people in, you know, in China, Vietnam, Japan, the UK, Canada, all these corporations, all these banks, all these individuals, they all get all these dollars. And if they don't live in the US and they're not going to immediately use it for trade, well, what do they do with it? They recycle it back into US dollar assets. And so that has kind of propped up the US economy, the US markets for the last, let's say, 30, 40 years. And again, if there's a change in global reserve currency, especially quickly, you could see an unwind where, yes, in 2 to 3 years, you could absolutely see a hyperinflationary scenario developing in the United States because of, you know, mass dumping of US bonds, US equities, the Fed responding with QE infinity, all these dollars flowing back to the US, and then finally, you know, inflation returning in a major way and causing all these feedback loops to develop.
Do you think the tariffs, the Trump negotiating tariffs is part of this, where he's kind of saying, look, we have levers we can pull on too if you're not going to continue to leave the dollar as the reserve currency? Do you think that's part of the conversation, or is it? I know there's a lot to that, but I just wanted to get your thoughts on that.
I think Trump understands, right, the importance and the power of the dollar as a global reserve currency and the unique lever that they have to pull. And these other countries, you know, although they do obviously have a large amount of US dollar assets, they are also their economy is dependent on exporting goods to the US. And so if you cut that off, that cuts off a main source of economic growth for especially for a lot of third world developing countries in Asia, for example. And you know, that's why these tariffs, I think, were, even though they were brutal, they were actually more effective than what most people thought, because a lot of these countries immediately caved because they realized, you go and do the math and realize when 20% of your GDP is exports and you're gonna basically tank that to zero if you stop trade with the US, well, what are you gonna do? Like, would you rather come to the negotiating table and say, okay, we'll drop our tariffs if you drop yours, or would you rather be a hardliner? And most people will, you know, most countries will choose the latter. And all this is part of Trump's strategy, I think, to at least attempt to reindustrialize the American heartland and to bring back the manufacturing jobs that have been lost in the last 50 years.
TB, do you think they're going to? I don't understand the mechanics of this. You might, you know, I remember seeing some posts here and there leading up to Trump's second presidency that they could repeg the dollar to gold, or they could, I think Kennedy even posted something about this, that they could repeg the US dollar to a basket, including Bitcoin, that they could repeg it to Bitcoin, gold, platinum. Like, you could use precious metals and Bitcoin to secure the dollar. Do you think we're way past stuff like that? I mean, Bitcoin would be a new way to secure the reserve currency to something that is finite, so that's just not print, print, print. But do you think we're going back to something like gold? That seems like a reversal, but I don't know what your thoughts are, or what that would entail, or how easy that would be necessarily as a transition.
Yeah, no, it is a difficult thing to conceive of, but the best way to think about it, right, is what would behoove the people in power to do, right? Like, what are their options on the table? Well, completely going to a Bitcoin-backed system, at least especially in the short term, is not really in their interest, right? Because they have control over the fiat financial system, and if they, you know, they don't want to give up that control, they don't want to give up that power of owning the printing press, and gold is a great intermediary where they could potentially back or reback a portion of the US dollar or all of the US dollar with gold at obviously a much higher price. And then let's say revalue the debt or restructure the debt that they have outstanding. And again, if you look at their actions, like who cares about what they say and who cares about what any of us think? Let's just look at their actions. Global central banks in 2024 bought record amounts of gold. The first quarter was the strongest quarter in history of 2024 in 2024 for central bank gold buying. Poland, India, the UK, like basically every central bank globally is buying gold, including the PBOC. And the Fed, at least on paper, the Fed and the US Treasury claim that they have all the gold that they have on hand. But if you look at the, and I did a podcast about this on my Substack, if you're interested in checking that out with Eric Young. But if you look at the import export numbers, there was around for in the last like the numbers are now a little outdated, but as of like early March from the prior 2 months, so basically January, February, there's around 2,000 tons of gold imported from Europe. Now around 700 of that was gold from the LBMA, which is what's called non-monetary gold. That's gold that's just in bars, that's for banks, that's for individuals, that's for wealthy people, right? Pension funds, whatever. They're just redeeming, they're basically calling in their gold that they have stored in London and pulling it back home. But 1,300 tons was unaccounted for, and the only way it would be unaccounted for, the only type of gold that doesn't have to be officially marked in the import numbers is what's called monetary gold. And monetary gold is gold that's in specific denominations, like 100-ounce bars that are used to be stored at Fort Knox. And so Eric's conspiracy theory and my theory as well, given the evidence, and there's other pieces of evidence as well, but that's one of the main ones, is that the US is actually redeeming its gold certificates because right now Fort Knox is likely mostly empty. They lent out all the gold, they have a bunch of certificates, and so all the gold is floating around in London, in Singapore and Hong Kong, and New York. And so Fort Knox is finally, the US government's finally saying, okay, we need to have all the gold back and we want to, make sure we have our you have physical ownership in case of a global restructuring of debt. Because it's almost like a game of hot potato, right? It's ownership and possession is 9/10 of the law. And so if you actually have the gold, then you can, if you have to do a restructuring, you could go and tell your creditors, hey, look, we actually have the gold. Here's the certificates. Like, here's the actual like holdings. You can see it. You can physically audit yourself. If you just have a bunch of paper promises, that's much, much weaker, obviously. And so it's not only, like I said, it's not only the US, it's Germany. Several other nations are looking to redeem their gold certificates and just redeem for physical gold. And so I think that that's clearly showing that the powers that be are at least thinking about this shift.
I saw where they were saying that Doge was going to audit Fort Knox. I don't know who posted that or if that was actually real, but I was kind of like, oh, that should be interesting, but I think you're right. I think there has been a get your stockpile back, because and China's stacking a lot too right now, not Bitcoin, but gold for sure. So it's going to be interesting to watch how that plays out with the two powers along with Europe and how this gold, Bitcoin, fiat thing works its way and what occurs. There's a bunch of ways we can envision it, but we still don't know. It's a little bit like Bitcoin itself, where we're not quite sure how it's going to unfold, what's going to happen. There's a bunch of curveballs that are likely to be thrown and things that we don't see happening. You wrote, and I love this, you wrote, quote, "We are all in the midst of a massive shift, one that most people can feel but not articulate." I love that. You go on to say, "The old system built on debt, taxation, and traditional labor is breaking down. The new system, driven by digital sovereignty and decentralized opportunity, is rising. And for now, they coexist in an uneasy, chaotic balance," unquote. That captures a lot in just a few sentences, but I can also feel what you're talking about when you said everybody kind of feels it. It feels like the crumbling of an old empire that's very corrupt, and we can kind of see what's emerging that is way better but it hasn't really fully been built. We're seeing little kinds of things emerging, like Nostr. We're seeing things built on the decentralized ledger in Bitcoin that are going to serve humanity, but a lot of them are not in the public awareness yet. They are for early adopters like us and us to kind of spread the word that there's something else being built so people can look and see, wait a minute, this is freaking me out that, the stock market, is just tanking on this news or whatever. But I'm hearing murmurs that something else is being built to replace some of the systems. And this goes across society. This is media, this is social media, this is medicine. Like, there is no place I think that the decentralized revolution is not going to massively impact. But I wanted to get your thoughts on, where it's heading, what you're excited about inside of that kind of tension between the two, watching one kind of crumble and being a critic of maybe the old system at the same time. We're so early that people don't even know about Nostr yet, really. I mean, nobody I know, besides you and me and Ben, like nobody I talk to, not even my wife, is like, what are you doing with that Nostr thing? Like nobody, not even in my house do they know about it. So, yeah.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think so. COVID obviously accelerated this trend massively, right? We saw, gold and Bitcoin generally just mainly having adoption from the neo-Austrians and, the monetarists and, hardline crypto punks and software engineers who were like autistically spurging out about gold standards and hard money and stuff like that. And it was kind of like a cultural relic of basically like the gold days, right? And it didn't really have any popular appeal or popular adoption. But with the advent of the COVID-19 virus and then the subsequent lockdowns and the ensuing inflation that followed in the wake of the lockdowns to deal with the economic catastrophe that was caused by those restrictive policies, we saw, people finally starting to realize that, why am I paying taxes if the government can print the money they need to spend for these vaccines, or if they need to print the money they need to spend for, stimulus checks? Like, this is insane, right? And people realized in mass that prices were rising much faster than the official CPI figures had said. And I talked about this in several tweets and several posts on Twitter. I made even a long form Substack about it. There's been people who've obviously been talking about this for years, that the government numbers are a complete lie, but they've been getting better and better and more, let's say, audacious and bold with fudging the numbers ever since COVID. And so basically, like, all of their systems have gone into overdrive. And in the wake of that, I think people started to become concerned about our monetary stability and about the future of the US financial system, because this is people's money, right? This is their earnings, this is their wealth, this is their life savings we're talking about. And so Bitcoin has emerged as the solution to that, obviously. And we've seen popular appeal rise incredibly massively, right? We now have corporations and even nation states talking about, like the US, talking about buying Bitcoin for strategic reserve. That was unthinkable 5 years ago. And so I think, people, especially people on the in the more dissident spheres, the people who are more maybe conspiracy minded, or people who are more, questioning the narrative around the vaccines, the narrative around the war in the Middle East, the war in Israel, the war in Ukraine, like people who are raising those concerns are coming to Bitcoin as the solution for the monetary issue that they face. But also, like you said, that Nostr, Bitcoin also provides the base layer for the solutions for other problems like free speech. You can have Nostr and have a completely uncensored, unregulated, uncontrollable social network that you wouldn't be able to have without the Bitcoin network.
Yeah. Are you telling me, PB, the government's lying about inflation?
I know, isn't that
Oh
shocking?
my, it's so unlike them to not tell the truth about something to the people. Like, oh my God. I don't know how I got so lucky, man. I feel so blessed because I'm not a cypherpunk. I'm not a developer. I'm an o, you know, I'm 58 years old, and I'm not a technologist. And I think I just got so damn lucky, man, that I was sitting at home during COVID, tweeting shit about stuff, talking shit, right? I was just kind of like poking at things, but Bitcoin came across my radar and I didn't have anything else better to do. I wasn't working at the time and I was just kind of like, I just went down the rabbit hole. And once I started clicking on stuff, it just started making more and more sense. I mean, I put in probably 100 hours. I mean, my wife was like, "What, are you still looking at that Bitcoin stuff?" And I was like, "Yeah, there's something here I'm trying to understand." And yeah, I just feel super blessed. And I try to do podcasts about it to help my listeners start to maybe pique their curiosity so they'll go down, because you can't learn it, as you well know. You can't learn it on one Substack. You can't learn it on one Michael Saylor video or one Breedlove video or Saifedean's book. Like, it kind of takes all of it. It kind of takes all of it. You got to commit a little bit of time to putting in the proof of work, as we say, to arrive at the same place you and I have arrived at. Are you really bullish? Are you super bullish on Bitcoin? Like, I'm trying to train myself right now to not really look at the price, and it's really hard because I'm just so curious all the time about what the hell's going on. But I'm trying to train myself to have a low time preference, which is a long-term vision. Just, I know I'm in a good asset, and it's just my job to protect it in self-custody, keep my mouth kind of shut about, stuff, and just, I'm trying to help people on ramp their own learning more than I'm trying to talk about. I don't give financial advice. This is not financial advice for anybody, right? It's you got to do your own research. That's the beauty of Bitcoin. But yeah, I'm just trying to create enough curiosity and enough listeners that they'll start to go, you know what? I'm going down the rabbit hole, and maybe they'll end up buying a Trezor cold card or Ledger or whatever, and start to stack sats and self-custody, because I think the more people that do that, the brighter the future will be for more people. And I don't know what your thoughts are, how bullish you are on Bitcoin right now, moving forward.
Yeah, I'm extremely bullish. Again, the way I approach it is, for especially for the layman, you have to think about this from the terms of the denominator, right? What are you dividing Bitcoin by? You're dividing Bitcoin by dollars, right? Because you think everything is priced in dollars. I buy my food in dollars. I buy my gas in dollars. I pay for my mortgage. I get paid in dollars, and I buy Bitcoin in dollars. And then most people think, well, I want to see that dollar number go up. And the reason why it will go up in reality is because the denominator will continue to collapse, right? We're facing a macro environment now where the US government is 36, almost $37 trillion in debt. They're adding 100 or $1 trillion of debt every 100 days. The interest expense on the debt is now the third largest line item in the entire US budget. And it's
Jesus.
and that's over $1 trillion as well. The longer we keep interest rates high to fight inflation, the more that debt spiral starts to worsen. And then, ironically, if you lower rates, right, to let's say lessen the interest expense blowout that we've had the last few years, you just cause inflation to spike again, right? Because lower rates means more lending, more stimulation of the economy. You likely have to do QE again, and more QE means more money flowing into the system, which causes more inflation. And then that causes the deficit to blow out. And as the deficit blows out, then that causes, the debt to blow out. And so either way you slice it, like if you want to keep interest rates high or cut interest rates, the debt is going to continue to grow exponentially. And the rate path of the US debt, we're talking $40 trillion within, easily a year or so. We're talking like around, or actually, no, for, sorry, $40 trillion within 2 years. We're talking $45 trillion easily by the end of the decade, $50 trillion just a year or two after that. Like, it's an exponential problem. And when you have a government that's trying to pay off an interest expense that's that large, you quickly get into a scenario where it becomes unpayable, and they just have to print every single marginal dollar in order to pay just the interest. And so once we reach that level, which we obviously haven't yet, I think the deficit's at $2 trillion right now. Gross federal receipts are around like 4.3 trillion. The the debt payments are 1 trillion, so it's about like 25%, right? But as that continues to grow and swallow up more and more of their tax receipts of their income, you know, we'll get to a point where basically the entire all of our taxes are just going to pay interest on the debt. And that's a scenario which is completely untenable for the Federal Reserve, for the US Treasury. And that's one where there just won't be enough demand for the debt, and they'll have to print every single marginal dollar, basically. And again, that's a very, very inflationary scenario. And when that breaks out, I expect Bitcoin to go much, much higher. And so, kind of like Larry Lepard says, it's just math. There's no way out of this situation without causing massive economic pain, either deflation or inflation. And every single government in the last 200 years has chosen the inflationary path. And so I don't expect the US to be any different.
It's going to be interesting to watch this. I don't I'm a natural born optimist, which I think is why I gravitate into the Bitcoin, because there's more optimism in the Bitcoin communities than anything that I see. So I think I'm kind of predisposed to kind of get over in that community because I want to feel like things are moving in a good direction, even as I watch the old system crumble. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is where, you know, again, people can get caught up in the doomerism that of what I just laid out, right? They can get concerned and say, "Hey, that sounds like we're basically screwed. Like our pensions are screwed. Our purchasing power is going to go down. The value of my house in real terms is going to go down." And that's where I would say, well, Bitcoin is your lifeboat. Bitcoin is the solution, right? Bitcoin's going to not only grow in value and keep pace with inflation, it's going to outperform it. And so if you invest in Bitcoin and you hold your savings there, you'll be okay, and you'll survive and get to this next economic system much, you know, much more wholly than you would if you did not buy Bitcoin. And the other solution too here is, right, like a Bitcoin-based financial system that we may have in the future after this monetary reset would be much, much more equitable and fair for everybody than the current fiat system we have now, which is based on corruption, grift, you know, fraud and lies.
You've probably seen this more than I have, PB, but I'm looking forward to, because you've traveled internationally and stuff, I'm looking forward to actually buying, ribeye steak with sats. Like I want to see more businesses thriving in the Bitcoin economy. I think that part, for me anyways, that part has grown slower than I thought. I thought more and more merchants would be like, oh, let's get this, because if somebody pays you $100 for steaks in sats, it's gonna be worth like $1,000 fiat in probably a 5 or 6 years. Like it's like you're actually getting paid in something that's gonna go up in purchasing power over time. So to me, it's like it would be super attractive for merchants, but merchants just aren't quite there yet. And there's not very many places that you and I both live in and around Seattle. I don't see too many places where I can buy stuff with sats. I would love to, pay for something on the Lightning Network, just about anything I would, just to encourage the merchants. And I don't know if you've seen it. I know probably Ben has because he's down in South America and stuff. There's probably more places. Have you seen that in your travels and had the pleasure of being at a conference maybe where you guys were paying with sats?
Yeah, I went to the Adopting Bitcoin conference in 2023, and we were able to pay for all the food, all the drinks, all the snacks,
Nice.
people's books and sats. Like basically everything was denominated in sats as well. The Bitcoin conference, you can also buy a lot of stuff there in sats. They have the option there, and they give you like a 10% discount. More broadly though, obviously it's a slow and steady fight to increase Bitcoin adoption, especially as a payment medium. And a part of the reason why that is, part of the reason why it's so difficult is because of something called Gresham's Law in monetary economics. Gresham's Law states that, you know, bad money drives out good, which sounds counterintuitive, but it actually makes sense if you think about it long enough. Because, you know, if you have like for example, during Gresham's time, he was an economist in England, in Victorian England. If you have gold and silver, and then the gold is undervalued and the silver is overvalued, or another way to say that is, let's say the gold inflation rate is 2% and the silver inflation rate is 7%, then why you would want to spend the silver, even though it's a worse money objectively, you'd want to spend it into exist, you know, spend it into existence, spend it, use it for transactions, and you want to hoard the gold because you know that the gold is depreciating more slowly than your silver is. And so because of that law, I think Bitcoin is going to face a headwind for medium of exchange adoption, at least in the short to medium term. Now, that's not to say that it won't become a medium of exchange, but I think that the Bitcoin price has to be much, much higher, and the price also has to be much, much less volatile in order for us to get to a medium of exchange, being widely accepted enough to be useful as money. And so right now, there's the three functions of money, right? There's store value, medium of exchange, and unit of account. Right now, we're still in the store value phase. We're still working through, like, what is Bitcoin actually worth? Let's see it, have extremely volatile moves to the upside. Let's see it explode higher, then explode lower, and people get liquidated and all that stuff, and all these financial derivatives created around it, and all this gambling and betting that happens with every single, financial instrument occur. And once we move through this phase, which I think we're actually, maybe two-thirds of the way through, once we finish that, and let's say 5 to 10 years, Bitcoin settles at $10 million a coin or whatever your model, says it will, then, and once it stabilizes there, then you can start to see it used as a medium of exchange. And then as it becomes more and more widely accepted as an MOE, it'll be a unit of account just by default.
Yeah, that's really great. I'm glad you introduced that Gresham's law, because I think as a Bitcoiner, I can feel both tensions, the desire to have mer reward merchants for being early adopters and wanting to see businesses thrive that have adopted it as a payment. But also I can feel my own, like, it's one thing to buy stakes with sats, but I don't really want to part with much of my Bitcoin, because to your point in Gresham's law, the fiat is not going to be worth as much. So if I'm going to buy, something that's really expensive, I'd rather pay fiat for that than my precious sats. If it's something that's, like a house or something like that, I don't really want to part with my Bitcoin. I would rather part with fiat, because I'm trading a depreciating asset. Maybe real estate's going to depreciate too, but right now it's sort of an appreciating 5% a year. So it feels like a positive, a net positive overall, where Bitcoin, in my model anyways, and the stuff I look at, it's going to appreciate faster than certainly the fiat, but the real estate as well. PB, is there any, it was awesome to talk to you as usual. Is there any creative project? Where do people find you in your writing? What do you got going? And where, anything else you'd like our listeners to know about, but mainly where can they find your writing and all your work?
Yeah, sure. So I'm obviously on Twitter at Peruvian underscore bull. I also have a YouTube channel with the same handle. Just look up Peruvian bull on YouTube. My main work is at dollarendgame, substack.com. So just look up dollar.endgame substack at substack.com, and that'll give you to my main work. All the links are in my bio on Twitter, so that's like an easy way to find it. And then I have the aforementioned book Dollar Endgame for sale on Amazon. You can buy it there, but you can also find it for free online. So I've put out everything basically except for my exclusive Substack stuff for free. And so if you want to read Dollar Endgame and you just don't want to pay the $30 for the paperback, then you can go ahead and find it on Reddit as well as Medium, for free, and just read the whole thing online.
Beautiful. Well, thank you, Peruvian Bull. So great to chat with you. Let's keep track of one another and enjoy that beautiful weather out there today.
Will do. Thanks so much, Tony.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation as much as I did with the always insightful Peruvian Bull. To get his read on macroeconomics and what is happening with the dollar and Bitcoin, go subscribe to his excellent Substack under Peruvian Bull. Thank you, base campers, and we'll see you around the fire next week. If you find value in our show and wish to show us some love, we are now making that very easy to do. You simply go to www.basecampformen.com and click on Donate Support Basecamp. You'll find an easy way to make either monthly donations for as little as $5 a month, or you can donate just once. We love the monthly donation and hope to build this up over the coming months, but any show of support is greatly appreciated, honestly. Thank you for your support and for helping to keep Basecamp as a resource on your hero's journey. That's our show for today. Thank you for listening. Men, good luck in all your endeavors, and good luck on your hero's journey. This is Tony Rezac, and you're listening to Basecamp for Men.